if you want to get like basically a bachelor's degree in how to travel, you need to go to where all the travelers are. And that would be the classic TMBA, three stops, Vietnam, Thailand, and Bali, right?
Hey, podcast listener, even if you are alone in your entrepreneurial journey, know that today, right now in your earbuds, you are joined by thousands of entrepreneurs from all around the globe seeking to grow better, more profitable, location-independent businesses. If you'd like to learn more about what we do and download our entire back catalog, check out tropicalmba.com. Happy Thursday morning, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Welcome back to the podcast, Boss Man. We are here. It is launch day. It's an exciting day in the business. We were both kind of up late last night. Maybe we'll bring the listenership a little bit into the excitement of a launch day.
But first, let's talk about your shirt. Where did you get this shirt?
Let's drive some value for the audience. Yeah, that's right. I bought shirts for DC, Mexico. Cool. So I figured we're going to this fancy resort by the beachside. I'm packing my bags. And I notice that there's a distinct lack of tropical flavor in my packing. And so I thought, well, I got to solve this problem.
Wow. You're disguising yourself well. It's a button-up shirt. I know this is a podcast. It's a full button-up shirt, but you're disguising yourself well because most guys that are from the East Coast wear an undershirt under their button-up shirt. And you're not wearing an undershirt, so good job.
I got my chain, though, so I still got some East Coast going on. All right, Ian, today this is going to be a different sort of tropical MBA episode. I talk with my good friend, Barry O'Brien, who recently returned on an 18-month trip around the world. He shares all the numbers, how much it costs. I'll tip you off, $100 a day, about his favorite countries, his least favorite countries, how he packed, how he prepared, what he learned, just old school travel conversation. Stick around for that. I want to talk about this product launch that we were up late last night working on. I pulled up this email in my inbox. We did an episode late last year, and we were talking about the difference between being in your business and being on your business. And that this was one of the major themes we were talking about at our DC Black event in New York. Anyway, I get this email from a listener, and he writes, I would love to be in a group with entrepreneurs who are focused on growing to seven figures. Because of course, DC Black is for entrepreneurs who've already achieved seven figures. He said, I've got a DC mastermind, which is a huge step forward. And I have a group of friends that I text regularly about my multi-million dollar business ambitions. But if you ever start a DC Black undergraduate program, I'm interested. And I flag up this particular email because we got a lot of emails like this or around this issue of like, why isn't there something to help me get to a million? And I responded to this particular center and I said, we're going to do it. Just give us some time. And last night at 2 a.m., we were doing it. So that's sort of the backstory. And so I'm really excited to announce DC Accelerator, which is a program by us designed for founders who want to accelerate their progress to $1 million in revenue. And the idea is everybody who joins is laser focused on that one goal. And I get it. There's lots of things you can do with business. We're in the lifestyle business game. You can optimize for time. You can optimize for travel, like we're going to talk about today. But a lot of good things get unlocked at that $83,000 a month level. Opportunities, the chance to build a team, the chance to build meaningful wealth, have exits. A lot of listeners of the show are sort of raising their hand and saying, hey, actually, this is going to be my revenue year. And I want to focus on getting to that next level. And I'm looking for something that can help. If you have a business coach, it can really augment that relationship. Or if you don't have a business coach, it can provide a lot of that value for a lot less investment. And that's basically the concept of the program. There's a bunch of different elements to DC Accelerator. There's one-on-one coaching. There's facilitated masterminds by experienced seven-figure founders. There's mentoring from people in our network and DC Black members. There's live events. It's all kinds of cool stuff. I'm particularly just excited about the concept. I've always loved this concept of just getting people together to have a communal goal. It's like 1 million or bust. I've raised my hand. I'm dedicating this year and part of the next year to getting my business to $1 million in revenue. And I'm going to do it with a bunch of other people that are on the same journey. And to me, that's what DC Accelerator is all about. It's not meant that you hang out in DC Accelerator for 4 or 5 years. It's like, it's this concept, you get in there and you get out. We're looking to celebrate those wins, unpack the plans and the patterns that reliably lead to that level. So if you're curious, it's launch day, like we said. Click through on your phone and apply today. And if you have any questions for us, just send us an email. Our contact information's on the page.
Final note, Dan, today is also launch day for DC Black, where there are 100 members in that community now. So go over there, check it out. We have a bunch of new things coming down the pike for those members as well.
Super cool. I see some new live events.
That's right.
It's exciting. All right, cool. I have to finish packing my bags to see you and so many listeners of this show in Mexico. But for those of you that aren't traveling this weekend, I've got a great episode about 18 months on the road featuring my good friend Barry O'Brien. So we are going to roll that here. Any final comments, Ian?
Feeling a little bit of shirt envy. I wish I would have got to Amazon sooner. I'm going to see if they can deliver to the...
You're just
going to
show up in a classic white tee? That's not enough. It's Mexico.
Oh, man. I've made a big mistake.
All right, man. We'll see you next week. I'm looking forward to bringing some stories back from Mexico and sharing them here on the podcast. So let's roll the interview. Let us know what your name is and what it is that you do.
Yeah, my name is Barry O'Brien. I am a global traveler who just returned from 18 months of traveling.
Can you bring me to the moment when you started thinking about traveling the world for a year or more?
It was a dream I've always had. I'm from Ireland, and it's very common for that to be done in Ireland. I think it's a little less traditional to be done in the States. In terms of, you know, in Ireland and the UK, they call it the gap year in uni. So like, it's a very well-beaten path. 17% of Irish people actually live abroad at any given time. And so if you don't do it in Ireland, it's actually kind of considered a bit like, well, what's wrong with you, you know? But like, I've been in the States about 11 years, so I just assumed it wasn't going to happen for me. And I was going to get my life in the States set up and things of that nature.
And what ended up happening that opened the door for you?
You know, I was living paycheck to paycheck for like a long time. When I first got to the States, I was about $51,000 of debt. And I actually found like Dave Ramsey on the radio, and he had a guest on who was like, hey, like, I'm a significant amount of debt. And they listed out their debt, and I was like, that person's an idiot. And then I realized that that was me. And I actually ended up paying off the debt I had over 18 months. And then after that point in time, life became a little bit more flexible. That's when I started to re-engage the dream that I had had before I left Ireland.
How extreme were you with the Dave Ramsey stuff? I mean, 18 months is a pretty quick time to pay off $50,000. Like, what adjustments did you make there?
So one of the most extreme things I had to do was I completely cut back on... I started writing down all my costs, basically, and tracking them, and started like figuring out like where the fluff was. The biggest offender for me was like Uber and like Lyft. I was a serial Uber Lyft user. I was like in Boston, right? And you can get the train, but Uber and Lyft, I was an Uber and Lyft addict, right? So I was racking up a couple of grand a year and that. So that was easy. But I started getting really innovative around, you know, at the time I was doing an MBA, I started, you know, getting very innovative of like how to create avoidance to like adding to the debt. So I was able to get the MBA. The MBA was about $94,000 tuition. I was able to get it to about 20 out of pocket. So like the way I got there was like $50,000 from my company. And then I worked with university on like community service, which is something else I do. And then just completely cut back on my savings and started paying off the debt. The other big thing that I had to do mindset wise was like, I was sitting on a lump sum of cash that was emotionally hard to let go of, right? Because it meant that I had to go down to like having less cash there as a cushion, but it was too much cash for what I really needed for my situation. So the emotional thing I had to do was let go of that big pile of cash and put it towards the debt. That was about like 15 grand. Then I was up to 35, and then I just cut back to the other things. But the other big thing was this, using Dave's approach on the snowball. So starting the smallest debt and getting to the highest, you know, paying them off sequentially, smallest to largest, because I started getting quick emotional wins. And through those emotional wins, I was able to like create momentum. And with momentum, I was able to finish the job.
When you paid off the debt, do you remember where you were and how it felt?
I think I was definitely in Boston. And like, I remember knowing the moment when I was going to pay it off. And that was when I brought the total debt from five figures to four, meaning like I paid from $10,000 down to $9,999. So like, and the debt consisted of like student loans, like car I got for like 17 grand, student loans were like 30, credit cards at four, typical profile, right? Like, but I remember when I got to five figures instead of four, and it was like, wow, that psychologically was one of the best days in my life. Because I was like, I know I'm going to finish this. God, I can remember that very well.
You immediately started to think of travel as a possibility when you were out of debt. I want to flag that up and see if you remember anything else about that, because that was the same emotion that I had for some reason. When I was in a job, I remember I would look at consumer purchases, like a nice car, and I would kind of fantasize about the car and the loan that would be associated with it as something that I could almost do that would give me agency. Like, I'll just get this nice car. I can afford the payments. And I started going the debt-free direction, and I got a horrible car instead. And it was like the moment that I was debt-free, I was sort of starting to think of options. I felt like I had options. When you started to sit down to think about this world trip, how did you do it?
It starts with like, where do you want to go and what goals you want to achieve? So I wanted to play golf in St. Andrews. I wanted to eat street food in Vietnam, like Anthony Bourdain did. And I wanted to visit South America and practice Spanish. So like, these were like three goals, right? Out of that, like there's three continents. So how do you divide three continents into 12 months, right? And so how I did that was taking into account all things, which was really starting with my budget. You know, my budget at the start and before I went was $100 a day.
And how did you come up with that?
Number one was a number I could meet from a financial independence perspective and cover up to 70% of that through like passive income, which I'm sure we'll cover later. And this other 30% would be a reasonable level of cash burn that could bridge me for the period of time that I needed to be away. In addition to having 12 months of savings for when I got back to America, got back home in the event that I didn't have a job. Didn't, job market's down, can't get a job, et cetera. So it was a combination of comfortable level of cash burn and a comfortable level of savings when I got back for like the worst case scenario.
So essentially you're saying you can travel the world for about $36,000 a year.
Yeah.
Full-time without working. And some people might look at 100 and say it's a lot. Some people might say it's a little. How would you describe the level of comfort you can achieve right now for $100 a day traveling the world?
I would describe $100 a day for the itinerary that I had as incredibly comfortable in comparison to at least those two places. Full disclosure, I earned about $100 a day in Austin and it's tight. In Vietnam, it is extremely comfortable. Talking about like, you'll have your hotel covered for, I'm just taking Hanoi, Vietnam, $25 a day hotel, right? Sometimes the hotel is all food inclusive. That's 25 with food, at least one meal. Eat out, that's another 10, that's 35. Travel insurance, cell phone, that's 40. And then throw in some entertainment on top, like take a few tours, that's 55 bucks a day. Couple of coffees, that's 60 bucks a day. That is a wonderful quality of life for $60 a day, which, you know, is like 20 grand a year.
You mentioned travel insurance and cell phone. What sort of planning did you do before you left? Did you put your stuff in storage? Did you get a different cell phone carrier? What sorts of those things did you do? Meta kind of planning.
Some of that was like analyzing different scenarios, right? Storage or no storage was one, right? So like I went with no storage simply because it's less complexity. Also cash burn, it was going to hit my cash burn that we just talked about, right? So I went with no storage, which meant no possessions. So even right now, I've whittled my whole life down to, and this is kind of like, I suppose, into keeping with the fire mindset is like
financial independence, retire early.
Financial independence, retire early. And maybe this is like an extreme version of that, but like I call it like 30, 60, 90, right? I've got like 30 days food, 60 days clothes, 90 days of cash, and everything else is in the market. So like, how do I simplify my life basically to the maximum I could? And then You know, what else did I do before I left?
Let's walk through your itinerary. Can you talk us through basically how you progressed around the world?
So started in Western Europe, Ireland, Scotland, Portugal was Western Europe. Western Europe was a natural starting point because it enabled me, being Irish, to go home and spend some much quality time with my family that I hadn't done in a couple of years. Scotland was a pure hedonistic golf play of like trying to play, live a dream of playing golf in Scotland. Portugal was a natural stopping point from a cost perspective. Because so before I went to every country down, I analyzed the cost, security, and internal logistics within that country, right? Countries can be great, but it's no good if you're going to be stuck in one place for the whole time, right? You've got to be able to move around easily in there. So we went to Portugal after that. Portugal was an action stopping point. And then out of that, the next continent we started thinking in continents was Southeast Asia. If you want to learn about traveling, if you want to get like basically a bachelor's degree in how to travel, you need to go to where all the travelers are. And that would be the like classic TMBA, three stops, Vietnam, Thailand, and Bali, right? Which is like where I got my like bachelor's degree in like traveling. And so in Bali, like you just hang around the coffee shops, you know what I'm talking about, like hang around the coffee shops, meet other travelers, where it's good to go in this region, where isn't. Indonesia, Southeast Asia, you start talking to people, you start picking up tips. I'd actually never been to Asia before, believe it or not. And so Bali was like a natural gateway into it, the world of like Asia for me, right? So like greeted at the airport by the driver and like, he was like, welcome to Bali. I said, thank you very much. It's just welcome to Asia, right? Like, this is awesome, right?
So Thailand, Vietnam, Bali, Philippines, Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar. Mm. What was your first impression arriving in Bali with all kinds of preconceived notions of what Asia would be like?
It was a culture shock. Bali was a nice little gateway. It's pretty westernized and it's kind of like set up a little bit for Westerners, but it was an utter culture shock, especially as I got to know the Balinese people. I mean, it's one thing getting to know the tourists, but I got to meet a lot of Balinese people through like tours and things like that and just hearing about like what was priorities to them and what wasn't. For example, we're very conscious in the West of like getting into a motorcycle accident or like being on the scooter and like insurance and all these things. Balinese are just like, hey, let's just see what happens. You know, like kind of like carefree, like hop on the back, you know, like there's two or three people on the back of your, you know, Grab scooter. And if you get into a crash, so be it. Like, and if you get into a crash, it's like, let's sort it out like Dan DeBarry, like let's not get the police involved, that kind of stuff, right? So coming from the States where everything is like, this is the box, don't go, it's like the box, right? Like it's just kind of like blew everything open, right? Like just kind of like free spirit. Coming from the States into Bali, it was into Asia, it was a little bit of a culture shock at the start. But again, had we been dropped into like Cambodia, I think that would have been a much bigger culture shock, quite frankly.
And so how long did you end up spending in Southeast Asia?
So 6 months. And the reason for that was because I was under some green card. For any green card holders out there, what I did was I returned to the States every 6 months to keep a continuity on my residency in the States. So when we went to a new continent, we spent 6 months there from that point in time.
So after Southeast Asia, you moved on to South America, to Peru, Colombia, and Ecuador.
That's correct.
And that was another 6 months?
That was originally supposed to be 6 months. We made a decision after 3 months to return to the United States because I, at that point, spent 12 months outside the United States while coming back every 6 months, but spoke to my immigration attorney. He said, you can probably keep going if you want, but maybe you don't want to do that. Maybe you want to come back to the States, which is what I did. And so we continued our traveling in North America after that. So it was like Chicago, Philadelphia, spent Christmas in New York, finished a trip in New York City.
And how was the $100 a day budget in New York City versus Western Europe versus South America?
Let me tell you this, by the time we'd 18 months experience of like traveling at that point. So we were able to actually get New York, and you know me, I have every number like written down, like write down all these numbers. Like I was able, we were able to do New York for $84.48 a day. And that was in Manhattan. So by comparison in like Portugal, it's like $88.09. It was actually cheaper to do New York, believe it or not. And the reason for that was if we'd started in New York, we would probably have been like $150, right? The reason we were able to bring that down was we got so good at the process of locating and sourcing accommodation. At the beginning of the trip, we'd spend a week in Porto and a week in Lisbon and a week somewhere in Madeira. At the end, we were like, let's spend 30 days in a central point, which makes our lease longer, which gives us greater negotiating leverage with the Airbnb hosts, getting up to like 20-25% off with the Airbnb hosts, and then working on their dates. So just stop by that. We just got way more savvy at bringing down the cost of expenses with accommodation, food, and flights were the three biggest costs. 80% of the costs are going to be accommodation, food, and flights.
What are tips for getting the most affordable accommodation and flights?
Okay, so for flights, we use an app called Hopper, which is predictive analytics. So you don't need to know exactly where you're going to be all the time, but if you have a rough idea, you can put different scenarios into this Hopper predictive analytics app. And the other thing we started doing too is we, at the start, really inexperienced travelers, we had suitcases, got rid of the suitcases, went to backpacks. With backpacks, depending on the size, you're able to do hand carries or hand luggage. And with that, you don't have to check the bags. I mean, some flights we were on, Dan, the checking the bag is more expensive than the flights, like in Vietnam and in Thailand, et cetera, and in like Colombia. So you want to have the backpack. You want to have a reasonable size backpack that you can bring on with you. So that can just cut off half the cost of the flight straight away. With accommodation, depending on the app you use, I would say 70% of our accommodation was Airbnb. And after a while we started figuring out that if you are very flexible and work with the host, because you can go in Airbnb, you can go into the host's occupancy and vacancy dates. You can see exactly the days that they don't have guests. So if you can work your dates around them and make sure that they have 0% vacancy and offer them a long-term lease of 30 days more, there's not a host in the world that isn't going, I promise you, they're not going to deny your request for 15 to 25% off.
I kind of wanted to get you to talk in superlatives about maybe the most underrated and overrated or best and worst of each region for you personally. Maybe we could start with Western Europe. Were there places that were overwhelming or underwhelming?
I think on the overwhelming side was Portugal. Never been to Portugal. Portugal is highly livable. I think a lot of your listeners are in the United States. I think the proximity Portugal has to the United States is incredible. It is like a 7-hour flight from the East Coast. The food is incredible. And the weather, you know, everything, a lot of digital nomads. So Portugal really impressed. And price point is pretty nice. Underwhelming, I absolutely love Ireland, and I'm probably going to get some flack for this, but there is a housing crisis in Ireland. And the biggest challenge Ireland has right now is like accommodation. And that's kind of like spilling over now into impacting tourism. So finding a place to stay bang for the buck, probably depending on the time of year, is going to be really hard. But what I will say is what you get back from Ireland is you get the hospitality. So if you as an American are like driving around in Ireland and your car breaks down, you can knock on a door. You can get out and walk and knock on a door, and that person's going to be like, come into my house, have a cup of tea, I'll make you a sandwich. I'm going to call the police. We're going to get your car towed for you, right? You cannot beat the people of Ireland. It is like absolutely the best people in the world in terms of like tourism, right? In Southeast Asia, for me, almost overwhelming country, Vietnam. Always had heard about Thailand. 90% of my traveling friends have been to Thailand. I would say maybe 40 to 50% have been to Vietnam. So Thailand's the one you always hear about. Thailand is awesome, by the way, from my point of view. But Vietnam, with the food, the history, the people, incredible. $2 street food, top 10 to 15% meal I've ever had in my life every time. Right? There's a reason why it was Anthony Bourdain's favorite country. And then the history is really interesting. The Vietnamese people were just amazing. So, and the cost per day is highly, highly sustainable. I think a lot of your maybe listeners are like small business owners, and if they're looking for ways, if they're looking for opportunities to take costs, and they're location independent people, if they're looking for ways to take costs out of their business or take costs out of their lives in order to reapply or deploy that capital into their businesses, I could move from Austin right now. I'm spending about $35,000 a year to live in Austin. I could move to Vietnam and live there for $17,000, $18,000, have a better quality of life, and put that $17,000 or $18,000 into my business.
I want to pile on because my formative gap year travel experience was when I was 19. And at the time, early days of the web, Thailand had a much bigger brand as it does now. And I remember I had a friend who's much more worldly. And he said, you know, we have to go to Vietnam. And I remember thinking, yeah, sure. I mean, I'll go, but I'm way more excited about the prospect of seeing Thailand. And I had this imagery in my head of this tropical paradise and all these amazing temples and things like that. I was so much more profoundly affected by the experience in Vietnam as well. In fact, that when I first quit my job, that was the first country I moved to, because I just wanted to spend more time there. And it sounds like we had a similar experience there. There's something about the interactions I had with Vietnamese people was very different than the interactions I had with Thai people. I found the food to be more interesting, the cities to be endlessly interesting, and the countryside as well.
Absolutely. And one small anecdote was, of the 15 countries we went to, the one that I had emotion and tears rolling on my face at the idea of leaving it in that plane, on the tarmac, leaving that country, that was in Vietnam. There was something so spiritual about being there.
Let's talk about South America then, some highlights and lowlights there.
Highlights absolutely were like, the country of Peru was like incredible. For anyone who's into food, Peru. And you know, we went to like Cusco, which is called the Rome of the Americas, where the Incan Empire traces back to. And it's also interestingly 17,000 feet above sea level. If you have any issues like breathing, maybe you don't want to go to Cusco like until you figure that out. But Cusco is absolutely incredible. Cusco is also known for like being the stopping, but the logical stopping point on your way to Machu Picchu. And so Machu Picchu is like 2 hours from there. So we went to visit Machu Picchu. It was cool, quite frankly, a little bit underwhelming. It was a 7-wonder of the world. I will say that we didn't have a tour guide. So I would recommend anyone who's going to Machu Picchu to get a tour guide, because I think the tour guides would put some context around what you're seeing. The best restaurant in the world, commonly referred to as the best restaurant in the world, is in Lima, Peru as well. And Lima is a gorgeous city that basically hangs over a cliff. And you look down this cliff, it's like a 100-foot drop. You're in the city center, it's a 100-foot drop. And there's people surfing underneath your feet. And kite surfing and doing all these crazy things. Food is absolutely spectacular. Peru is a great country that I really, really enjoyed. Underwhelming a little bit, I would have to say probably Machu Picchu. I know like for us, I know thousands of people go there, but for us, it was cool to go to a 7-wonder of the world. Maybe we didn't know what we were looking at really. And we should have, you know, probably should have got a guide.
You know, one of the things that is commonly discussed is travel in South America versus Southeast Asia, because they're common backpacker destinations. Did you notice any top level differences between the travel culture and ease between those two regions?
Absolutely massive. The biggest one is language. So in Southeast Asia, 80% of the people there speak English, right?
Or 80% of the people that you interact with.
Yeah, exactly. 80% of the locals, people at the restaurant, people at the drivers, right? The Airbnb hosts. I naively and like ignorantly assumed it would be the exact same thing in South America. I could not have been any more wrong. It is like 20% English, 80% just frankly don't. So the biggest top level difference is the language.
What about safety?
Safety. So I have to say, like anyone who's been there, and if you're thinking about traveling, female solo travelers and couples and whoever, Southeast Asia is like incredibly safe. You've been there. Okay, there's parts of like Bangkok probably, and like parts of like big cities that you may want to like avoid. But for the most part, it kind of reminds me of Ireland, right? It's like the people there, if I'm driving on a scooter and I break down in the middle of nowhere, right, in like North Vietnam, odds are if I find a house, the people there are going to like be helpful. Come right in, that kind of thing, right? Just like Ireland is. So I would give like Southeast Asia a strong 8 or 9 out of 10 for safety. South America, you have to be a little bit more vigilant, depending on where you are. Lots of places in South America are very safe. I would say that we were in the Galapagos Islands and they were very safe. We were in part of Medellin that we stayed in, El Poblado in Colombia. It was very safe, I would say. But you have to be very vigilant in South America. And I was told that in advance. And again, that's where speaking Spanish comes in. You want to be able to speak to the locals and go like, where should I go? Where shouldn't I go?
Any thoughts on the US? You visited some major US cities.
The most unsafe moment happened on a New York City subway. I don't want to focus too much on negatives. We were getting like a train to the JFK airport and we were just It was like 3 a.m. Our flight was like 5 a.m. That was a mistake. Just get an Uber. Don't go on the New York City subway that time of night. Yeah, there was some trouble on the train. We were like locked into the carriage and we got around it. But like that was the most unsafe moment of the whole day. And nothing happened, nothing came of it, but not a nice experience.
What are some of the most memorable travel stories that you remember from the 18 months? I remember you started off, you were going to do 12, but then you extended another 6 months, right?
A lot of weird things from a geopolitical perspective happened while we were away. The Queen died. We were actually in Edinburgh. We were 20 minutes from Balmoral Castle where she died. Talk about like once in a lifetime something to witness. They brought her body through the streets of Edinburgh. We were supposed to go to Edinburgh Castle that day. They were like, no, we're closing that down. The Queen's body is being brought through the streets of Edinburgh. We stood there and watched the monarch for like 60 years. Talk about once in a lifetime moment to witness that and see that, right? I'll never forget that, you know, especially being from Ireland and being growing up so with so much proximity to the UK and to the Queen and things like that. It was an amazing once in a lifetime thing. The other weird thing that happened was like in Thailand, about a week after we left, the military performed a coup on the government. So we narrowly missed some fireworks there. We were in Ecuador and 2 days later, the president of the opposition party got assassinated. And we narrowly missed some interesting fireworks, no doubt about that. So like just kind of weird happenstances. And like, I have to say to anyone out there who's thinking about traveling, like try and do a better job than I did at doing your homework on some of the political landscapes and stuff you faces you're going to. Maybe that can be included in the ChatGPT prompt is like, please include political stability. But I have to say one of the biggest memories from the trip was we were in North Thailand. We took a day trip to Myanmar and there's a small little village on the border of Myanmar and there's a civil war going on in Myanmar right now. And you can't just like rock up. You have to go through some checks. It's on the border with Thailand, but a couple of things were like just completely stood out and were incredible. It was a small little market town, maybe like 10,000 people. And people are speaking two completely different languages a kilometer apart. And my Thai guide cannot converse with the Myanmar people and vice versa. It is completely cut off. And they're like using sign language and they live a kilometer apart. That was completely and utterly mind-blowing. Compared to Thailand, it was like going back in time. But the most important thing that happened there that has stuck with me and will always stick with me is that for a country at war that is so far away from like even Thailand's GDP per capita, not to mention the United States' GDP per capita, children on the streets coming up, playing with us, happy, people smiling, people being friendly, couldn't speak a word to each other. For a country that was at war, for what they had, people were happy. And if anyone's in Chiang Mai or Chiang Rai in North Thailand and wants the day trip to Myanmar, I'd be more than happy to put you in touch with the guide. She's awesome. Just reach out to me. But yeah, so that was one of the travel stories from Myanmar. And then I think one of the other things that happened too was we came to New York and having just been all around the world and heard all these languages and seen all these faces all around the world and not knowing anybody from the millions of people, like going really months without seeing a familiar face, right, is like something that was in of itself as a traveler. Going months and months with seeing thousands, tens of thousands, millions of people's faces and not recognizing one of them or knowing one of them while you're traveling is like an experience of itself. Like getting to New York, it was like a full circle moment, right? There was like over 1,000 or 6,000 languages that are spoken in New York City. So we're walking down like Fifth Avenue, right? And it's like, I'm looking at people's face, something simple as like face structures. I'm like, that person's from Peru. That person's from Vietnam. That person's from Thailand. You listen to them. They're speaking Thai. They're speaking Vietnamese. They're speaking Balinese. I realized that America is maybe the only country in the world or one of the only countries in the world that has everybody under one umbrella. And, you know, if you go to, like, all due respect, if you go to Thailand, you go to Vietnam, you go to all these places, the people that live there that are residents, it's like 98, 97% homogenous. I think it's 40 million immigrants that live here. That means 40 million people that were born in a different country. And so if you go to New York City, seeing all that full circle made me really appreciate more. And something I've been taking for granted is like no one in the world has done what we've done here.
Has your year and a half abroad changed your feeling now when you're back home?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm an immigrant and I spent a lot of time trying to get here and I appreciate every day that I have here. And going away only made me appreciate everything we have here more, from the infrastructure to the opportunities to the diversity. But it also opened my eyes to the things that they have on the other side of the world that we don't have, which is sometimes we place a little bit too much of an emphasis on our careers and on our possessions and whatever it might be. And there's peace that can be gained from not chasing money.
It's cool. Is there anything else you want to say about traveling the world on $100 a day?
No, nothing else to add. Just to track every dollar. You know, you're spending more than you think you are, and that's a good rule of thumb, whether you're traveling or not.
Barry, I want to talk for a moment about financial independence, retire early principles. Many of us in the entrepreneurial world are focused so much on the next revenue cliff, the next sale, that sometimes we lose sight of our business and personal expenses. I'm wondering if you could give us a crash course in your approach to managing expenses, and what are some good approaches to doing so?
I started with Dave Ramsey, right? Step one is like debt-free. Like for me, was like just clean out my debt, pay back my debts, don't have debts. Because once I didn't have that, then it's flexibility, whole mindset shift. So I followed Dave Ramsey's steps pretty religiously at the beginning. About 3 or 4 years into that, so this is now we're getting to like 2019, I found out about FIRE and the FIRE movement. And this idea of like living off of the four, you know, having FIRE movement's basic premise is like, you have a nest egg, you pull 4% off of it and you live off the 4%, right? That became really interesting to me of like a sustainable way of how to travel. So like I got about combining the two schools of thought, because Dave does carry some stuff about net worth, but I really got into like net worth and like managing my net worth and figuring out like how much of my net worth can I deploy into like creating a return on the 4%. And so roughly about 80% of my net worth is generating dividends and generating passive income, right? Which makes traveling a lot more sustainable. My philosophy as I probably get older is when it comes to personal finances, like I kind of had like shiny object syndrome for a while. I was like, oh, it's crypto. It's like this or it's like that. Or like, I got to chase this, got to chase that. Like got to set up Amazon dropshipping, got to like set up a YouTube channel, right? Like all this stuff. And I was listening to like episode 591 of TNBA with Noah Kagan. He's like, the surprising habits of wealthy people is like, they just do one thing really well. And like, so if I had gone to head, if I just do one thing really well, if you said like, Barry, you can only do one thing for the rest of your life, but if you just had to pick one thing, it'd be like dividends for me. But I can see like the returns I generate on dividends are like far better use of my time than like YouTube and other things. Cause I just put so many hours into learning about dividends. It's like simplification and like getting a return on investment for like things I'm good at. And maybe like spending less time on the things that I just probably don't know that much about. Cause yeah, the average lifespan is not really that long. Like it's like what, 76 is the average lifespan in America. Like I hope to live beyond that, but it's not a long time.
Well, if I were to sum up your strategy from the outside, it's you're a very high earner. You have a very low burn and you hustle a lot. So you have entrepreneurial sources of income. And then you focus on dividend stock investing, which are stocks that pay out dividends on an annual basis, provide you
exactly
with passive income.
So my steps are like, as you said, income. After that, it's like, I need to have my living expenses covered. How do I optimize that? And using some of the principles from traveling. Next is like, how do I pay off my retirement accounts? Right? I'm in a career job, right? So like, I want to have the 401k and all that sorted first. And then after that, it's like, well, every dollar after that, it becomes like a decision matrix, right? Is it going to be real estate? Is it going to be dividends? Is it going to be like investing it into a business? There's arguments we make for any of the three of them, but like generally speaking, on an average, typical, boring year, like my biggest returns are going to come from dividends.
Can we talk about USA citizenship for just a little while?
Sure.
I'm wondering if you could walk us through this landscape a little bit, because a lot of listeners are fascinated by the concept of going through a green card, whether it's because they want to come to America or they have a friend or partner that wants to come to America. I'm wondering if you could walk us through a little bit of your experience and any advice you have for others that are thinking about becoming, you know, the 32 millionth and one person to live here.
The barriers to entry in the States, from a landscape perspective, the barriers to entry in the States are gargantuan. There's only really four ways you can get into the States, and there used to only be three. But like one is like you marry a US citizen. Number two is like you get hired by a company and they bring you over here and they sponsor you, which is what I did. And then the green card lottery is the third way, right? So every country has a green card lottery. You're all assigned spots. So in Ireland, it's interesting. If you enter the green card lottery in Ireland, you have an 8% chance of winning 8. If you enter the green card lottery in China or India, it's like less than 0.11% or something crazy. So depending on the country you live different odds. So if you're living in Ireland and your ambitions are to go to America, I would suggest you enter the green card lottery because you have a 1 in 12 chance of winning, right? If you're very patient for 12 years, you have a decent chance of winning. So those are three traditional ways that you get in. And the fourth way that's more coming up as a trendy item is like there's been new bills where like if you have X amount of employees and Y amount of revenue, like the states will try and create some accommodations for you to own that business in the US. It's kind of like a new, over the last 10 years.
My next call is with a friend who's done that actually. Interesting you bring that up.
The steps that I took, I went with a company route. My company sponsored me. I first came over on a L visa, which was a managerial position, manage like people, process, or thing. You're qualified as a manager, you get on as an L visa. So if you're working in a company abroad and you want, and that company has offices in America, you can say to them, I would like to do this. Is it possible I can have an opportunity to do this from the United States with an L1 visa? Other common visa in that category is the H1B visa, which is like slightly different. The L1 visa makes sure that you stay with one company during the tenure of your visa, which is up to 7 years. The H1B visa is different. It's like you can work in any company over a course of 6 years. It's more of a company independent visa. Not quite sure the process for all that. After the L1 visa, I was approved for a green card within my company. That's very expensive. It can be up to like $20,000 for the company to spend that. It's a big investment of the company in you. I'm very grateful that my company, my former company, did that for me. So after 5 years of being on the permanent residency, which is the typical tenure, you have to be on permanent residency for 5 years, you become eligible for citizenship. And that's what I did this year. After 5 years being on the green card, I applied for citizenship and I was able to do that. I believe also just want to mention that like, depending on the country you're from, again, it can be longer times to get your green card. I believe it can take a lot longer. I've heard of people being on the green card for 15 to 20 years. So I was, again, very fortunate, very lucky. You know, that's a little bit of the track of like what I've taken to get citizenship here.
You said the US is the hardest country to get into and the hardest country to survive, but you're 4 times as likely to become a millionaire.
We've already covered like hardest to get into, right?
Yeah.
Some people say, and I don't want to be provocative, but it's one of the hardest countries to get out of as well, by the way. And one of the reasons for that is because you are one of like, we are one of like 6 countries in the world that tax our citizens who live abroad on income.
Yeah, that's a longer conversation, but yeah, definitely.
I have to say that like the immigrants I speak to in this country, they love every day they're here. They think this country has created more millionaires and billionaires than any other country in the history of the world. It's the greatest economy that's ever been created. There's an exclusivity to be here that you don't see if you're born here sometimes. And so outside looking in, there's a massive still, I think there's a massive appreciation and admiration for what the US has done in its like 300 years of existence.
America's like the club with the line out front is essentially, it's the restaurant with the red rope. And there's a bunch of people lined up. Barry O'Brien, thank you for joining us on the Tropical MBA podcast.
Thanks very much, Dad.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Tropical MBA podcast. You can go to tropicalmba.com, get access to hundreds of back episodes and all kinds of other goodies. Load up your iPod. That is the cheapest way to fly business class on your next international flight. We will see you next Thursday morning, 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.